Back together again, you and I, kicking off a brand new week, Monday, June 10th, 2024, on Connecticut Today, where we started with breaking news of UConn men's basketball coach Dan Hurley deciding to stay in stores and forego an offer from the NBA's Los Angeles Lakers. National Taxpayers Union Foundation VP of Research Demian Brady talked about the future of the Internal Revenue Service, and Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill gave us his weekly take on the big state and national stories as well.
Well, he's staying, as you have heard by now. Danny Hurley, UConn men's basketball coach, is not going to Hollywood. Now, it turns out this Lakers offer that had been rumored to be around $100 million, which would have been just, you know, I guess record-shattering for any sort of coach, especially in the NBA. Listen, I follow the NBA close enough. I've never heard of a coach or anybody in management level making $100 million. But he is staying. He is not going to the Lakers. It turns out that the offer was, as is being reported by local media and national outlets too, including, of course, ESPN, I guess, that was first on this today, $70 million. So if you do the basic math here, $70 million contract divided by 6 years comes out to about $11.5 million a year that he was being offered to coach the Los Angeles Lakers. And I guess if you extrapolate that out to what they call a yearly value, it's not bad. So it's still a lot of money. I mean, people were talking about a 10-year contract at $100 million, which would have been, look, even I can do that math, right? $100 million divided by 10 years is then carry the 3, 1 minus 4 divided by 3, square root of 4. Oh, it's $10 million a year. So actually, if these numbers are accurate, he turned down a 6-year deal, not an aggregate higher number, but about what? 6-11s are 66, and 3 more is 69. So round the 2, drop the 3. Yeah, about $11.5 million a year. Listen, I don't know what it's like. I was joking with somebody here in the connoisseur offices. I don't know what it's like. With all due respect to the wonderful people I work for, most of us don't know what it's like to say no to $11.5 million a year. There are some people in this business that do, a couple of which I used to work with long time ago that have moved on. But so Danny Hurley turns down about $11 million, 6 years, $70 million to coach the LA Lakers. Now, you wonder, and this is going to be interesting, and I start with this because I'm fascinated with the machinations of this stuff. And again, because UConn is our flag on the hill. It's our flag on the mountain, right? When you think about it, there aren't too many things that people agree on in this state other than UConn sports. So I was in awe at the amount of emotion that this thing was causing over the weekend. Danny Hurley's going to leave. And I'm a pragmatist. I was saying on social media, you know, if somebody is offered, which he wasn't, it turns out in the end the initial reports were wrong. But if somebody is offered $100 million for something, it's awfully hard to say no, especially when it would come from one of the marquee franchises in the field you're in. Now, I know he's not of the NBA, but still. The Lakers and the Celtics, to that matter, Celts in the final now. You know, the Lakers and the Celtics are, to the NBA, what, you know, even to this day still, the Montreal Canadiens were to the NHL, or, you know, the Packers or the Patriots to the NFL and the Yankees, and maybe the Dodgers are to Major League Baseball. So he turns it down. So now the interesting thing is, Did you kind of, and this is going to be the interesting backstory, and tomorrow I'm hoping to have my buddy, my pal Dom Amore, longtime buddy of mine in media, writes for the Hartford Courant, covers a lot of UConn stuff. I chatted with Dominic earlier in the day, and he's just so busy, and I figured he would be today. But my angle on this, the thing I really want to find out is, did UConn step up to the table to offer more? That's it. Now it's the backstory that's going to come out. Now, last year, when UConn won its second straight title, Dan Hurley's salary, so the base he made last year was $5 million, okay? So he was making $5 million heading into last year. So he accrued another $2 million in bonuses for, you know, winning the Big East, making the tournament, making it to the Elite Eight, making it to the Final Four, making it to the title game, and winning the title. And we told you about that. That was, you know, well publicized because Dan Hurley, as all the coaches are at UConn, they are state employees. But it's interesting because only a portion of the contract, and people are surprised when they see this, only a portion of the contract is actual salary on a state level or a state budgetary line. So usually with these things at UConn, and it was explained last week when Gino Auriemma got his five-year extension till he's 75 or so, for example, Gino's salary line is only like $400,000 or something like that, but they actually end up being able to exceed legally by state law and pay Gino more and pay Dan Hurley more and pay Jim Mora Jr. more to coach football because they build in media appearances, speaking fees, and all that. I don't exactly know the machinations of that, how they do that, but Danny Hurley ended up making $7 million last year. So we'll end up, but it's going to be interesting to see where he is now going to stand on the pantheon of, you know, highest paid college coaches heading into the March Madness a few months ago when UConn won it. The highest paid men's college coach in America was Bill Self. And Bill Self made last year, I don't know what it is this year, it may change from year to year, Bill Self made $9.6 million a year. So at the end of last year, there was about a... Now, Bill Self's bonuses, I see here, were only a few hundred grand. So likely the coffers of the Hurley family are going to be better. I don't doubt that. And listen, did Dan Hurley do what some people would say would be the smart thing? And you hear this term in sports contracts all the time between players and coaches and managers, you know, they played this team off of the other. They played them to get a better deal. Well, that's, you know, that's it's negotiating. I did that once in this business. I was working at a radio station that, you know, I liked working at, but I didn't like my salary, and I went to another station where I had another role, which was fun, but, you know, it wasn't all that enthralling is the first station, and then after 2 months, the first station called me back and said, hey, will you come back and we'll pay you X amount more? Done. Deal. No contract. I'm not going to do that now. No, I've matured. Yes. So Dan Hurley is back. We'll see for how long. And listen, he's only, what, 51? So he could coach another 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years here and still take another gig somewhere. So good for him, and I'm sure he's going to get a raise from UConn. And again, I don't think it's lost on the athletic department at UConn or any of these other big schools around the country how unifying sports is. That's the big thing here. It's how unifying sports is. And I will bet you that if you took some sort of, I don't know how you do this, but if you took some sort of social metric measurement, how's that? That sounds good, right? If you took some sort of social metric measurement of how many people participated, say, in social media discussions of Dan Hurley over the weekend, you would see a landscape of people making minimum wage to people who run hedge funds and live in Fairfield County. You'd see people of all races, colors, creeds, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, Native American, all religions, Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Jewish, Shinto, Buddhist, whatever, because sports is a unifying thing. And there was a lot of sentiment that I could sense on social media, hoping and praying that Dan Hurley didn't go. You know why? Because, you know, the bottom line is, Dan Hurley, and to a little bit lesser of extent now, Gino Auriemma. Now, UConn women have had an amazing run, but a bunch of programs have kind of caught up to them versus UConn's men, who won titles previously, had a bit of a skid, and now they've been brought back by Dan Hurley. But, you know, sports is an amazingly unifying thing. And in a state that has its ups and downs, in a state that's just ridiculously expensive to live in a state that can just drive people nuts with how it does business sometimes in the cloak of night, in the dark of night, when the General Assembly should know better. When UConn wins, people are happy. It may not make sense, but you can't deny, and not just when UConn wins, but when your alma mater wins, whether you went to UConn or Wesleyan or Quinnipiac or Yale or Fairfield or Sacred Heart, you admit it. You watch the game, you pump your fist a little bit in the air, and you're sending text messages to your buddy, your pals, your girlfriends, your boyfriends, fellow alumna and alumni, and then, you know, you kind of, little light in the step. The next day, got a lighter step going at work. Hey, how about that game last night? So that, you know, in part, don't think that's not in the psyche of everybody involved here. And I know there are people out there, and I heard about it over the weekend. Well, these coaches get paid too much money, and teachers should make that. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Because nobody is paying hundreds of dollars a seat, or nobody is dealing in billions of dollars of broadcast revenue for teachers. They're just not. I hate to say it, teaching's a noble profession. But coaches make people feel good. Winning is a big thing. And we'll see how many more years that Dan Hurley sticks around, hopefully, to create winning here in the state and go for a three-peat, although that's tough. Now, that's kind of why I thought he might leave, but he didn't. Because with these one-and-dones and the NIL stuff, what a nightmare. But you know what? Maybe he's the kind of guy. He looks like, you think he's a type A personality? You think? He probably thrives on that. All right, federal taxes, they're not going away, I don't think. A lot of us just paid them. I know I did. I got a bit of a nice check back from Uncle Sam because I planned it out that way. Some people, some years I've paid, like some people have. People just want honesty from the Internal Revenue Service, from the IRS. They want some sort of competency. They don't want the IRS to be used on political targets. So let's talk about the Internal Revenue Service. Joining us right now, our guest is the Vice President of Research for the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. His responsibilities include producing commentary and studies on fiscal issues. He has also been quoted and reported on in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Times, and has been a loud voice about the IRS. Demian Brady is with us. Demian, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I am good, Paul. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Boy, I tell you, Demian, people hear the IRS, and I feel sorry for those people. I honestly do, because I don't know, Demian, if you think I'm wrong, but is there another government agency around where at the mention of it, you know, more people go, oh, my God. I mean, nobody likes paying their taxes, I guess. But where do we stand now with the IRS, the staffing, all this supposed new funding here, heading to an agency that a lot of people just don't like or don't think is fair? Clue us in on this.
Yeah, there's been a lot of troubles with the IRS, and the context of what's going on right now is that the IRS got a huge plus up to its budget in the Inflation Reduction Act, giving them $80 billion. And some of it was since rescinded, about $20 billion of it. And so that leaves a good chunk of change that they have locked in for the next couple of years. And, you know, unfortunately, the main priority of this funding was on enforcement, which means getting more money out of people. And, you know, the administration put together their package promoting the Inflation Reduction Act. And the word taxpayer services hardly ever showed up, but there was tons and tons of mentions of enforcement, because that's what this was intended to do, is to get more agents hired and get them to collect more money from taxpayers. Now, there are some people who are, you know, willfully not paying their taxes, mm-hmm. and the IRS should target them. But in a lot of other cases, taxpayers have disputes with the IRS about what should be taxable and what shouldn't be taxable. And some of these drag on in court cases for years and years and years. So a lot of Democrats like to talk about the tax gap, but it's like the unfunded, the unpaid, uncollected tax money. But it's not just a pot of money that they can go out there and grab. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Is part of the problem here, and you tell me whether you agree or not, is part of the problem here on the latter situation you talked about, not the former, because you're right, if you owe taxes and it's clear cut, you should pay them. No dispute there. Is the tax code too complicated? Is it too cumbersome? Are there too many gray areas that spawn these, as you say, often years-long disputes?
Yeah, the tax code is incredibly complicated. So, you know, in addition to sitting down and actually writing a check to the IRS for tax day, there's billions of hours that go into the preparation for that across the country. Taxpayers and businesses spend collectively $7 to $8 billion on all the paperwork and reading the laws and reading the forms, gathering receipts, and then filing that with the IRS. So it's incredibly complicated for a lot of people. So, you know, one thing that we could definitely do to make it easier to file taxes is to help simplify the tax code. That's up to Congress, but the IRS could also do a lot better job of training its employees to provide taxpayer services. And they try to put out some numbers to show that they're doing better, but when you dig into it, they really are not. For example,
sure,
they took the IRA funding, the $80 billion, and they front loaded the small portion of that for taxpayer services, so that way they can get more people answering the phones and then generate some good headlines around the country about, hey, look what we're doing. But when you dig into the numbers, their number of answered calls as a percentage went up, but only because there are a lot less taxpayers calling into the IRS. Mm-hmm. And even still, they only answered about 7 million calls in 2023. And it was much higher than that just 5 years ago. So they're doing less with more. And why is that?
So that's interesting. Wait a minute. Before we go ahead here, so they were answering more calls 5 years ago? Really?
Yes. the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration mm-hmm. is a watchdog of the IRS. So, for example, in 2018, I know numbers aren't great on the radio, but
sure. Well, go ahead.
2018, the IRS got 40 million calls in. Last year, they only got 26 million calls in. And 5 years ago in 2018, they answered 11 or 10 million calls. And then this year, they only answered 8 million calls. So why is we have this drop off over 5 years?
And what is the have they given Damien a concrete reason as to why there is the drop off? Or is this just a case of finger pointing on both sides?
Well, they're trying to take credit for it, but so they're kind of hiding the fact that they're doing less with more. And we're pointing out that maybe just a lot of taxpayers are getting frustrated and finding other ways of filing their taxes rather than calling into the IRS. And another issue, when you call in, the IRS needs to do a better job of following up with those taxpayers and getting some information on their level of service, which could be as simple as a question at the end of a phone call.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
on a rate of 1 to 5, press a button. Did you get what you not get what you called in about answered, or did you not? And that's something that the IRS should be able to readily implement.
The guest is Damian Brady from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. By the way, ntu.org/foundation. Go to ntu.org/foundation. You talked a couple of seconds ago, Damian, about the, you know, we've been hearing this for 30, 40 years. I mean, I remember hearing this when I, you know, four decades ago, two generations ago when I made my first tax filing. It has to be simpler. Let's simplify the tax code. People say for individuals with a simple return, you should be able to do it on an index card. Why has that not happened, Damian? Who is standing in front of that?
Well, there's the tax code has developed over, you know, decades and decades. And there's lots of changes to the tax code that get made every single year by members, by Congress as they enact these things. So that makes it more complex for the IRS because then they have to update all their new systems for any single tax change. But then in the meantime, as they're still processing tax cases, things that were filed years ago that they have disputes with taxpayers on, those are under different laws. So they have a lot of different things that they have to keep track of in any given year. And part of the reason is we have a very complex economy, and there's lots of different ways to raise money. And so then we have a complex system on top of that. We could simplify things by reducing some of the rates. And then there's lots of tax credits that have been created over the years. Some are beneficial mm-hmm. and provide, and some aren't. So the lawmakers could take a look at those and see, are we really getting a good bang for our buck for these? Because the ultimate goal should be to provide for a growing economy and have the government get out of the way.
Yeah, and you know, Damian, I remember reading analyses like this over the years, and please, you correct me if I'm wrong. You do this for a living, I don't, but have I read these studies, and we all know a study is not a real-world activity, but have I read correctly, Damian, these studies that said, you know what, you can simplify the tax code, really cut it back, make it clear, and adjust the brackets if you got rid of most of the deductions and still bring in the same amount, if not more, revenue to the government? I mean, I've seen all these stories and interviewed guests on this. What are your thoughts on that?
It could be possible, but you know, there's lots of different interest groups in support
of course,
some of these different carve-outs. And so there's lots of trade-offs that go on in Congress and in committees as they try to work out some of these problems. So we have major tax reforms come along maybe every 30 years where we have a major simplification or tax reform where we're able to cut rates. We had it in 1986, and then the next, well, there were some ones along the way, but then it wasn't until 2017 with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that we had a lot of provisions in there that simplified taxes for a lot of filers, and at the same time it reduced marginal tax rates at the top. But it also, which is one of the most untold stories about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, is that it ended up making the tax code much more progressive. You don't hear about that, but that's what happened.
Finally, Damian, if you could sit down, forgive me, I have no idea who it is, you probably do, but if you were sitting across right now, and instead of talking to me, you're talking to the IRS commissioner again, forgive me, I don't know who it is.
Daniel Werfel.
Who's that again?
Daniel Werfel.
Daniel Werfel, all right. What would you tell him if you could give him, if he said, hey, Damian, I've heard your interviews before. Give me one or two basic things that we should be doing here that would at least get us going on a better path here. What would you tell him?
Yeah, one thing that they can do is take some of this money that they got for enforcement in the Inflation Reduction Act. Mm-hmm. And instead of going out and using hiring orders and coming down with a heavy hand on taxpayers, they should be able to take that money and put it into hiring more agents for taxpayer services, customer services, right, and then train them better to help people. And then they also need to update their legacy software. It's among the oldest.
We have that problem in Connecticut too. Well, I mean, we were using software one time, Damian, from like the mid 80s. It's maddening, isn't it?
theirs goes back to the 1960s.
Wait, hold it. Before we wrap this up, the IRS is using software from the 60s?
The coding for its individual master file, which is the core database that it uses to process everything, is based on assembly language. And so they've been working on decades and decades and decades to try to update this to the the 21st century. Now we're already two decades into the 21st century, so there's quite a problem there.
Oh, Damien, thank you. Damien, thank you, and thanks for you and your organization doing this. At least we have somebody keeping an eye on them from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation, VP for Research, Damien Brady. Damien, thank you. Take care. Stay sane, and we'll talk to you down the road. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Damien Brady, D-E-M-I-A-N Brady, B-R-A-D-Y, from the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. That's great. The IRS is using software from the 60s. What's the software package called? British Invasion? Terry Cowgill here, Connecticut News Junkie, also Substack.com. He blogs there at Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Mr. Cowgill, how are you, sir?
Hey, not bad. All dressed up with nowhere to go except the radio.
Yeah, that's it. That's good. By the way, how does Governor Lamont say that we're going to make sure he's the highest paid coach in the country? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? I guess Ned is cheering for the old team, but I got to follow how he does this, Terry.
Well, I don't know how he would do it either, because he doesn't really have any control over UConn.
UConn, no.
It's the fourth branch of government. Everybody knows that. We don't want to violate the separation of powers amendment in the Constitution.
Yeah, or as one of my guests says, Chris Caruso, he proudly crowns UConn as the 170th municipality.
That's right. And the largest.
Yeah, and the state, yeah. To the matters at hand, you picked up on this, and everybody, Chris, I'm sorry, Terry, I was warning everybody in Lower Fairfield County here about congestion pricing. Here it comes, congestion pricing. A lot of you may have to drive into Manhattan. You can't take the train or for your own security or whatever. And now all of a sudden, Terry Cowgill, oh, never mind. The governor says, nah, the heck with this congestion pricing. It's gone. And by the way, there's an election coming up in November. You can't script this, Terry. You can't.
Well, every now and then, you can be as progressive as you want, or in some places as conservative as you want. But every now and then you get hit with the reality that what you want to do is very, very unpopular. and you had better backtrack on it. You know, Donald Trump is doing some of this on abortion as well. You see him moving back. This does happen. But the thing that struck me, and I have an online friend named Ken Girardin, who used to work for the Yankee Institute.
Yep.
And he's also worked for the Empire. I think it's called the Empire Institute in New York State. He's very familiar with both states. And he says, basically, New York City needs revenue, especially for the infrastructure of its subway stations and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And so this congestion pricing might generate $1 billion a year. So, but the thing is, they don't look at the costs. And one of the reasons that they need all of this money is it costs a damn much to do anything in the city. And for example, it costs $81 million to make a station, a subway station, wheelchair accessible. $81 million, and that's three times what peer cities pay for the same work. And we all know the reason. I think most of us who follow this stuff do, because in New York State and I think also in Connecticut, all local governments and school districts have to be subject to the prevailing wage.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so that means that even if you hire a non-union contractor to do the work, the wages have to be union. And the prevailing wage, guess what the prevailing wage is for laborers in New York City will be on July 1st?
How much?
$99 an hour.
Jeez.
Carpenters, $114 an hour.
Nice.
And they have all kinds of mandatory double and triple overtime pay, and even restrictions on how many apprentices can work on a job. I mean, why don't people look at this and say, you know what? maybe it's too expensive to build these things in New York City, and we need to reform how these things are built to keep expenses down. Then maybe we wouldn't even need congestion pricing. Good for her, though. I say she did it, maybe for the wrong reasons. But she did it.
Terry, there was an article a few years back, and I think it was actually I was stunned to see it maybe in the New York Times when they were nearing the end of the extension of the Long Island Railroad, you know, into Grand Central, which has been completed, and it's a beautiful new station, whatever, blah blah. And if I remember correctly, the Times, to their credit, I think they brought in like two German engineers, right, Terry? And they basically took them down there and they showed them what was going on. And these, you know, German engineers, basically their message was, okay, when we do this thing in, you know, in Germany or in anywhere in Europe, Italy, Spain, we generally do this with half the amount of workers for half the money. And I laughed. I said, well, there you go, right? Right?
Yeah. Well, the big dig in Boston was, I don't know, did that take place while you were in Boston? Probably a little bit later.
They were mapping it out when I was in school. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and, it got to be, I don't know, what did it go? Like 2,000% over budget or something? It was absolutely appalling, but that's what happens when you have these giant public works projects, is both the public and, to be fair, the private sector enrich themselves because they see an opportunity for what they think is an unlimited pot of cash, and everybody wants to grab their piece. So there you go.
Yeah, and finally, Terry, you know, the only way you say, well, this goes on, and again, I put this, I don't care whether you're on the right or on the left, I think you and I agree. This is on the squarely at the feet of voters. And when they don't even, Terry, I don't care whether you're far right or far left, but there are too many voters out there, Terry, who will not even entertain looking at somebody different because, of course, they can't, because the person that's been in office for 30 years, well, they got the Little League field down the street from me, the lights, and, oh, my grandson's elementary school has a new playscape because of that. And you know what it's all about, Terry.
That's right.
I mean, you know, it's
sad. How do you think Al D'Amato, a Republican, survived for 3 6-year terms as U.S. Senator in the state of New York.
What they call him?
Senator Pothole.
That's right. You see, into that.
I knew you were setting me up.
Yeah, okay.
He could get anything and he was great at constituent services, and that's how he survived.
Yeah.
And really, if you're not good at constituent services, as I think perhaps Johanna Hayes will discover, you're not good at constituent services, your constituents can be very unforgiving.
Well, yeah, we shall see. Terry, mm-hmm. before I let you go, you're smiling after game two with your Celtics. So are you cautiously optimistic here for your Celtics?
I am. I'm a little bit concerned that it looks like Porzingis is injured again. I haven't read much about it. It looks like he came out of the game and looked like his knee was sore. Oh. I don't think it's devastating, but he really, really helped them win that first game.
Yeah.
But I think that this series could go on a little bit farther than some people think. I don't think the Celtics are going to sweep them. Yeah. Might take 6 or even 7 games, but I just don't see how Dallas wins this. And of course, I've been a Celtics fan since the days of since the days of Bill Russell and all the greats and Havlicek and Bird and McHale and Parrish. So I'm diehard.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be the cakewalk that people seem to think it will be.
And finally, let me ask you, because I ask this of all my callers when they mention sports now, in the Cowgill household, when you sit down and you put your feet up and you've got your Celtics on, what might be your choices of liquid refreshment and or snacks? Or do you not do that during the game?
Oh, no, I drink red wine.
Nice.
But sometimes I pour myself a little treat, And I'll have a tequila and pineapple juice. That's a great one.
See, you're hardcore. I like this. Is good. Yeah. I like that. See, the easy answer, Terry, would have been, yeah, I like beer. No, you took it to another level here. Wow.
Dan Hurley.
Yeah.
I would love to see him three-peat. Right.
Yeah.
It'll be the first time anybody has three-peated since John Wooden at UCLA.
Wow.
He won, I believe, five or six in a row, won 10 total.
Yeah.
I would love to see him do that. That would be a great accomplishment and good for him for making the right decision at this time.
Yeah, he's still young enough. He'll get his NBA shot. But, you know, finally, Terry, I said earlier in the show, I give him credit because he's done it twice. He wants to do this again. And, Terry, this isn't like when you and I grew up, these one-and-dones. And I mean, Terry, maybe you know and I don't. Where's the NIL money in stores or in Hartford or West Hartford? How does he get these guys? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm trying to picture him, you know, in Laker territory. you know, they're both he and his wife are from New Jersey.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, La La Land is just not, you know, I mean, there's a lot, there might be a pot of gold there for him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. At what point do you say the money isn't the issue?
Yeah.
Quality of life is the issue, you know, and he's making, what, $3 or $4 million now? And it's going to be, they're going to sweeten the pot, as Lamont promised.
Yeah.
So I think he's smart to stay here and really build his legacy to a super level.
All right, Terry Cowgill. Terry, good to chat with you. Have a fine week, and we'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, there you go. Terry Cowgill, Celtic fan from Connecticut News Junkie and Substack.com. His blog, Red Meat for Mushy Moderates.